This podcast is part of the Podcast Arcade Network.
This is your ASMR message from Rainbow Comics and Cards. You can get all the greatest in comics, cards, and games at rainbowcomicsandcards.com. You can also go to Rainbow Comics and Cards Lincoln on Facebook and talk to Tim or Taylor, and they can give you some great comic recommendations. So thanks again to Rainbow Comics and Cards. You can find a link in the show notes. Hello and welcome to the Covert Nerd Podcast. Thank you for listening. It means a lot to me that you take the time out of your day to hear what I have to say. Please go to covertnerd.net for all the details on past episodes and ways to get in touch with me. You can easily do that by going to the show notes in this episode and click on the link and it'll get you there. So without further ado, let's dive right in and nerd it up. Today we have Lee Bachma here to talk about a card game that I've been had the pleasure of helping you on and giving a little bit of input on. It's been a blast, but I just wanted to talk to you about this game and kind of document where it all came from, what's so awesome about it, some good, the bad about it. So we're going to talk everything Hordes of Power. So thank you, Lee, for coming on the show and chatting and getting all this on the record, so to speak.
Yeah. No, it's once again a great honor and privilege to be on the Covert Nerd Podcast. I think this is my fifth or sixth appearance between the death matches and a couple other things. So I always have a great time. And let's talk some Hordes of Power.
Definitely. And I'll put a link in the show notes to past episodes if you want to, like I said, hear the death matches and other things we've talked about and hear all the conversations. But yes, today is the card game. So explain to the listener, what is Hordes of Power?
I guess let's do this the right way. So, dear listener, welcome to the Isle of Primal, spelt with a Y, so you know it's badass. You may have to bleep that out. Okay. Yeah, it's a land of savagery, science, and sorcery where barbarians and wizards and robots all vie for control of this island. To win the game, you have to build a legendary hoard of power and amass this army with the power to move 25 mountains. And the whole time you're trying to amass this army, your opponents are messing with you. They're kidnapping your warriors. They're murdering your soldiers. They're brainwashing units within your ranks. And you're doing the same to them. So it's kind of a cutthroat battle strategy game. And all these wacky characters in this fictional land of Primal, it is just a product of pure imagination. And anything kind of goes. Anything, like I said, from axe-wielding barbarians to three-headed robots to fortresses with faces on them that are sassy.
You know? It's got everything. I just love it. It's definitely shows your interest in all things sword and sorcery. And where did you draw some of these ideas from? You know, you mentioned lots of swords and sorcery. I guess tell the listener, where did some of these ideas originate?
Sure. Kind of from all over the place. There's so many different things that we have pulled from to make this game. But I think the largest, probably baseline influence was Masters of the Universe. You'll see a lot of Masters of the Universe characters and themes that are built throughout this card deck. Like Uklar the Mighty looks a lot like, you know, He-Man or King Grayskull. You've got Evilor the Evil, which kind of bears some resemblance to Skeletor. I mean, these are obviously tropes that, you know, Masters of the Universe didn't create these either. They're basing them off tropes them well. So it's not like I'm totally ripping off Masters of the Universe. They're just tropes that, you know, continue to build in this direction. And then there's been other cartoons and comic books that are in that same vein that I drew from as well, like Thundar the Barbarians, another one heavily drawn from. You know, the Ruby the Warrior Witch card is drawn from Princess Ariel in Thundar.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the other villains in there are based on villains that you see in Thundar. But tons of other influences, Black Star, Thundercats, those great cartoons. I read a bunch of comic books as a kid that totally fed into this, like the old Conan comics. You see a lot of tropes out of that are in there. The old Warlord comic book that DC had back in the 70s and 80s. There's a big splash of sci-fi in this as well. Like I said, there's robots. There's a guy from outer space named Bucko Backflash, which is totally a mashup of Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon.
Nothing is off the table.
No, I threw the kitchen sink at it as far as pop culture references go. In fact, there's some more modern ones in there that are not even sci-fi or fantasy based. There's references to the Big Lebowski. You just finished some card that's some Big Lebowski references. There's some Wayne's World references, Kevin Costner references, Sean Connery references, popular memes. If you look close, you'll see some cards resemble memes that are passed around the internet. So
I love the subtlety in a lot of these, that even on the surface, if you don't notice some of these, like Evilor is a Skeletor knockoff, so to speak. Even if you don't catch some of these little things, the game's still fun. So I guess that would be my thing to let players know. Is like, you don't have to be a kid of the 80s to really have fun with this game. It's there if you want it, but the mechanics are there just to make it fun.
Sure. Yeah, and I've heard that feedback as well. You know, guys like us that grew up on a lot of these tropes and we recognize a lot of these references, we identify with it, and it makes an extra level of fun for the game. But I have play tested it with some people, that like a lady in her late 20s, early 30s, who obviously wasn't raised like us, and she loved the game. I play this game with my 14-year-old daughter, and she loves it. Obviously, these references are totally lost on her, but she loves to play it, and it's just a fun, you know, family game.
I love that. You can get in deep, or you can just have fun in the shallow end of the pool, so to speak.
Sure, sure.
So when did this all come together? When did you start saying, hey, I want to make a card game, and this is kind of where I want to go with it? So take us back to the beginning.
I'll take you back to, I guess it was probably late spring of 2019, a little bit over a year ago, or maybe just about a year ago now. A friend of mine acquired this kind of wacky slapjack game. It was from Britain. And the slapjack game, it's a kid's game where you just roll the cards, and when a jack comes up, whoever slaps it gets those cards, blah, blah, blah. But this game was full of these wacky characters. Like Slapjack became like this barbarian on one card, and then there was like a space gypsy named Bada, and like another space pirate named Corel. And anyway, they were just these fun, wacky cards, and he found this amazing deck, and we were all kind of looking at it and just marveling at what was really just a simple children's game, but the cards made it so much fun that it made it into something more. And somebody, I don't remember who said it, because we were in a group, somebody said, wouldn't it be cool if we made a game? And everyone kind of laughed. Yeah, yeah, sure, it'd be cool. And then I went home and I'm like, you know, it would be cool to make a game.
Yeah.
So I started tinkering around with game mechanics, kind of came up with a rudimentary mechanics, and I actually drew the first version of the cards on the back of business cards. Yep. I kind of just, you know, in pencil wrote, you know, what the cards were. And then I actually played the first game with my, at the time, 13-year-old daughter. She's like, hey, Dad, this game's okay. But, you know, it's all right. And that's about the time that I started talking to you. And I said, hey, I made this game. I'd like to play test it with you. I want to get your feedback on it. And if you recall, the first round of game mechanics I had, it was functional, but it wasn't fun. Like,
yes,
the outcome was pretty much the same every time. There's only one way to win.
Yeah.
And you had to follow that formula if you wanted to win.
And the point calculation, if I remember correctly, was a little clunky and difficult.
There was a lot of math, or more math than you'd want in a quick.
And that's what kind of ruined the fun a little bit. Yes. Yep. Okay.
So I went back to the drawing board and kind of retooled the game a lot, brought it back to you and my daughter. And at this point, starting to introduce some other friends on as playtesters to get a larger swath. And the new format of the game is fun. There's a depth of strategy to it. It's still easy enough where you can learn in about 5 minutes. Most people pick it up, but there's several ways to win. There's a lot more ways to influence your opponent's army and kind of keep him down. Yeah, so it's just the second round of the mechanics really worked out. It's still, you know, evolved.
Sure.
Most of the fall, we went through several versions of it, but that base mechanic kind of stuck.
Yeah, that took about, what did you say, month to 2 months to kind of get it similar to where it is now.
Yeah.
Playtest after playtest after playtest.
Right. Yeah. The good chunk of the fall, I would say most of like September through maybe November, you and I did playtesting almost weekly. And then I got involved with a local group of amateur and professional game developers that live here in the Lincoln, Omaha area that meet biweekly. And, you know, you came a couple of those and got a ton of great feedback from those guys and gals. And they've been an instrumental part of this game's development as well.
A big thank you to Lincoln? I got the name of the group now. Lincoln Gamers Group.
I don't know if they have a formal name,
because
it's just kind of, it's an informal group that just meets biweekly, or it did before the pandemic broke out, but they would meet biweekly, and just whoever had a game that was going on would just get it out and everyone would kind of play it and give feedback and play test, and just a great atmosphere of camaraderie and willingness to help out other people that are of like-minded interests.
That's the thing. This whole process, no one's been greedy about it. They're just like, hey, I want to help you out. Unless it's been fun.
Yeah, everyone's been a great collaborator on this. No one's like, to my knowledge, no one's stolen this game idea and is like trying to publish ahead of me.
Mattel or whatever, saying, hey, I got this game idea for you. Well, you mentioned cards. So what were some of your favorite card games or board games growing up and why?
I'm going to go way back. One of my favorite ones, and this isn't a card game. It's not even really a board game. Do you recall a game called Crossbows and Catapults?
Not really. I kind of recognize the name, but if I saw it, I probably would recognize it.
It's, for lack of a better term, I call it a floor game.
Okay.
You had like this castle you'd build out of bricks, and then you had literally like a little plastic crossbow and a little plastic catapult, and you would shoot these like tokens at the other person's army like 6 feet away and try to ruin their castle before they ruined yours.
Like a Angry Birds almost.
Yeah, it's kind of like Angry Birds, and it was like Vikings versus Barbarians and crossbows and catapults. I had so much fun.
Do you still have that at home someplace?
I still have
you
it.
Do.
I will break it out after this. I'll show it to you. Okay. It's pure magic.
Let me put a link in the show notes to at least a picture of that. Crossbows and catapults?
Catapults. And it's been merchandised under a different name. I can't remember what the new version of it's called, but it's essentially the same game. And they've increased the game mechanics a little bit, where you've got to like do some measuring to where you put stuff. In the original one, it was literally just blasting away at the other guy's castle.
Do you love that? The simplicity.
Yeah. Let me see. Other 80s games that I loved. I played Dungeons and Dragons late grade school and through middle school. And there's some influences that have also gone into Hordes of Power, obviously another fantasy type game. Let me see. HeroQuest was another one. And that's kind of similar to Dungeons & Dragons, where it's a
very simplified version.
Simplified. It's not quite the role-playing elements of it, but it still has that dungeon crawl style element of kill the monster, take his treasure, get more powerful kind of game. And I loved strategy games as a kid. Like I loved Risk, Stratego, Axis and Allies. There was another spinoff of Axis and Allies called Shogun.
Oh, yeah.
Where instead of playing World War II, you played in feudal Japan, and you were like a shogun, and you'd have your ninjas and samurai armies trying to take over the island.
Pieces everywhere.
Oh, yeah. And that game came with thousands of pieces. Yes. You, like Axis and Allies, if you broke that thing out, you were in for like 8 hours minimum. It was a multi-day game.
It was great. I loved that game as a kid, too. But all those games you just mentioned, yeah, they have tons of pieces and just interesting game mechanic. Great art, like HeroQuest, the art, you know, you can put it on the wall.
Oh, yeah. The HeroQuest art was amazing. And even the expansion boxes, they all had like just high quality fantasy role-playing art.
Yeah, the days before video games.
Yeah. Yeah, or very early video games.
Yeah, the complexity on the 8-bit version of Atari 2600 just right. Not the same.
Well, yeah, those early like fantasy role playing games on those early 80s video games, they couldn't compete with what you could do tabletop. Yeah. Whereas now, like you look at The Witcher and Elder Scrolls Online,
Skyrim.
I mean, they're just amazing, and they can do everything and more that you can do tabletop or board games. So. But it was, it was the other way around back in the 80s. It was very simplified, those Atari games, the Riddle of the Sphinx and whatnot, that were dungeon crawl type games. They were simple.
It was all up in your head and just a strategy. So, well, besides Hordes, speaking of games you played then, besides Hordes of Power, what do you play now then as far as card games, board games?
Okay. Oh, I mentioned I played Dungeons and Dragons as a kid. I kind of took about a 20 to 25 year hiatus from that. But here last fall, I got back into Dungeons and Dragons again, and it's been great. I introduced a fifth edition, which obviously I played first or second edition back in the 80s when I played. So I had kind of relearned the game. There were some similarities, but some differences. And I want to say the fifth edition, they did a really good job with it. It's highly playable, highly fun, highly adaptable. You can do a lot more with it than you could back with like that first and second edition. Card games, I don't play it a ton as much as I used to, but I used to play a lot of Magic, and it was mostly with my daughter. My youngest daughter loved Magic. I'll be a bragging father for a minute. My youngest daughter is like, she's a prodigy when it comes to like learning and like mastering games in short order. And that's why one of the reasons I showed, like she was literally the first person I showed this game to when I made it Hordes of Power, because she picks up rules and mechanics and strategies so quickly. It's like freakish. I will teach her a game, and like 15 minutes later, she's like crushing me, and I'm crying because she has just mastered it to a level that I couldn't, do in 10 years.
So it's bragging, and almost you're almost scared to show her because she's going to just whomp you.
But yeah, when she was like 8, 9 years old, she learned magic, and magic's got a, it's much more complicated than Hordes of Power. Yeah. And she figured it out and she was good at it. And, you know, we still play it occasionally, but we used to play it like all the time. And gosh, she's good.
That's another, at least another question I was thinking of is finding that balance in that playtesting that we did with everybody is finding a balance. Like you talked about, okay, I don't want to make this complicated like Magic the Gathering, but I don't want it so simple like Slapjack.
Right.
Finding that middle ground is, has part been part of that process, right?
It has been definitely from the beginning. I wanted a game that people of kind of all ages could pick up in about 5 minutes, and it wouldn't be something that's daunting to a non-gamer that like, this game's too hard. You know, I don't want to play this. It's too many, like if you're a non-gamer and you try to explain like how to play Magic, or, you know, a gamer trying to teach a non-gamer Magic, they become overwhelmed quickly. And they're just like, this is the, what's that? The Cones of Dunshire or whatever. Yeah, reference. Yeah. This game is just like too crazy. Yes. Hard. So I wanted it to be simpler than Magic, but I didn't want it to be like you said, like Slapjack or Tic-Tac-Toe, where it's the same simple repetitive game over and over and over again. I wanted there to be multiple ways to win. I want there to be like a structure of strategy that you can learn and try to apply. And hopefully we found that balance. I think it's for the people who have played it, they seem to pick it up quick, and most people have a great time. Well, all people have had a great time.
Yeah.
Either that or faking it, at a scene, whatever, trying to make me happy. But yet there's some complexity to it too. It's no one's really said like, this is boring after you play it twice. People want to keep playing it multiple times because it's got some strategy and some replayability.
Does the replayability is fantastic. So I think you really found a good happy medium. But I know, like we said, that's part of the process of making the game is finding that balance and trying to get it where it needs to be. So
yeah, because the first version was too simple. Yeah. It needed a little bit more.
It did.
And I know when we were playtesting it with that group of game designers biweekly, some of those guys are obviously serious gamers. Yes. And they were throwing out ideas that they were great ideas, don't get me wrong, but it was taking the game to a level I didn't want to take it to. They wanted to take it to that complex, like Magic or Beyond Magic type level. And I was like, hey, great idea, but that's just not the vibe of this game. I want it to be fairly straightforward.
I remember that's one of the things I remember when we first started talking about it, is you said, I want to make this game something somebody can just grab in 5 minutes, be able to play and not have to weed through 12 pages of an instruction manual to figure all this out. That's what D&D's for, or that's what Magic the Gathering
Magic's for.
Not taken away from those games, but that's just not something
right.
a common person is going to go to Walmart or Target and just pick up off the shelf and take it home to the family.
Right. Yeah. I wanted the game to appeal to a larger audience than just hardcore gamers. I mean, I'm hoping hardcore gamers will also think this game has some merit and enjoy playing it as well. Obviously, they won't be completely, you know, satisfied or mesmerized by it because they're looking for deeper mechanics and deeper whatever. But hopefully, it's got that wide swath where, you know, sons and daughters can pick up the game and play with their parents. Friends can just sit around and be like, hey, we got a half hour to burn. Let's play some Hordes of Power. It's, you know, something casual, something fun, but yet still has a little bit of punch to it.
Well, what are some of your favorite cards and why?
So like I said earlier, these cards are a wide swath, everything from barbarians to robots to whatever. I guess the first ones I would like to go with is, there's a card named Growlor, and he's kind of this beast man looking card, this big furry monster. I mean, it's the monster trope, the werewolf trope, the beast guy trope. I don't like his card because I don't love his card. I mean, it's a good card, don't get me wrong, but I don't love it because he's on it. I love it because he's jumping out of this bush and he's grabbing this guy named Puffles by the head with his claws. Now, Puffles, he's on a different card, and Puffles is the cute but worthless sidekick.
Yes.
Another trope that you see like in all sorts of 80s cartoons and comics where to keep the kids interested, they'd always have these cute but worthless sidekicks. You know, you look at Orko from He-Man, Uni from Dungeons & Dragons. I'm drawing a blank on some. Looky from She-Ra. There are so many more. Well, Snarf from Thundercats.
Snarf, yeah. So there's four right there.
Yeah, so you can see, and there's tons we're forgetting right now, but in this game, Puffles is that trope, and he's this cute pink little flying thing that he's completely useless. So every card that he's featured on that someone else is killing or harming him, I love that card. So Growlor's card, when he's clawing the crap out of him, is great. There's another card called The Betrayed. It's this evil wizard that got betrayed, and he's got a whole backstory with Evilor. Well, he's getting ready to sacrifice Puffles with a knife to unleash this great arcane power. So those are some of my favorites, because I hate Puffles.
We did an episode way back, a deathmatch, where we had worthless sidekicks and how many ways can you make them die. So I'll put a link in the show notes. Here, Lee, go in depth on why he hates these worthless cute sidekicks.
Yeah, I wanted tough guy cartoons as a kid, and I He-Man had to have Orko, and Dungeons and Dragons had to have Uni, and it's like, why are you killing me with these sidekicks? Yeah, I did not like them as comic relief.
That's why this game is so fun, because it has those fun elements in it. But okay, so we got Puffles. What's another one?
Another one I really like, there's these two cards called Morpha and Morpho, and they're a brother and sister. They're two separate cards, but when you play them together, they have like a synergistic power that gives you extra points in the game. So you try to play them together. In addition to that cool power, what I really like about them is they're this kind of like mishmash of all these different influences, like Modulok from Masters of the Universe. Don't like that character. He's like this weird body-shaped, body-shifting monster that I always thought was lame as a kid. So I took that idea and I kind of mashed it up with from the Wonder Twins from the Justice League, where they were these two
super
twins
friends, yeah,
that would get stronger if they were together, right? So then I mashed those two ideas together. And then I kind of like twisted it in a weird way where, since Morpha and Morpha have this weird body dysmorphic shape-shifting ability, those brother and sister kind of like shift into each other in like kind of inappropriate ways that brothers and sisters shouldn't shift into each other. So it's a fun card where you're kind of like, that's gross.
Yeah, they're like shapeshifters. And I'll include a link in the show notes for these, but kind of I guess to describe it, they're kind of liquidy clay looking figures, and but put the two cards together, they kind of match together, which is a fun concept that you put the two cards together and they kind of fit.
Yeah, they do fit.
So that's just amazing.
Parts of their bodies are flowing into each other that should not be flowing into each other if you're siblings.
Exactly. I love that card. That's just, again, just fun little Easter egg, so to speak, in this card.
Yeah, well, that brings up an idea of another card that I really enjoyed is the Lady Bata card. Now, she's a flying pirate. She's the captain of the Sky Rovers. She's kind of this really saucy lady that she's a neutral card. She can be played good. She can play evil. She's kind of powerful. And the reason I love her is not only because she's kind of this sassy card that has a ton of flexibility in the game, but she's a reference back to that Slapjack game, the original. There was that Bata card where he was the Space Gypsy. Well, I changed Space Gypsy into Sky Pirate, you know, did a little gender bending. So now it's a female. And just a fun, great card with an Easter egg back to the original reference that inspired the game to start with.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, she's has all these ships in the air. It looks amazing.
The flying fleet, the Wind Rover fleet.
And they have these stories behind it, like we talked about off mic, is there's all these little stories behind each one of these cards that could easily be put into book form of some sort, whether it's a comic book or or just a write-up about him. And I know you have a write-up about him. And
I did like I featured six characters in a promotional featurette book, just to kind of introduce the game. And I gave some of those away as promotional items. But yeah, so each six of like the 64 characters that are in this deck.
Good. Yeah, 64 characters. So there's 64 characters. Can you give us a breakdown of the cards? I'll kind of put you on the spot if you remember.
Oh, sure.
Sorry.
Yeah, there's 108 total cards, 64. Four of them have various characters. The other remaining cards are the special cards, like murders, kidnaps, brainwashes. There's totem cards, which are kind of like these permanent curses that you can put on your opponent's army that cause them to lose power or lose cards or both. And then there's ways to get rid of those totems. So that makes up the remainder of those cards. And then out of those character cards, they're broken down between, there's good and evil cards, there's savage cards, those are your barbarians, your sorcery cards, your wizards, and then there's your science cards, your robots and technological cards. And that's kind of a general breakdown. There's some cards that fly, there's some cards that are robotic, introduces different mechanics to the game.
Like you said, nothing's off the table.
No, it's a wide berth of just kind of everything that was awesome.
Primal can be whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
And that probably makes it great. It ever does well and you want to expand, you can go anywhere with this.
Oh yeah, nothing's off the table.
Obviously not. You have more for Morpha.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what we already kind of touched on this a little bit, but how did you decide on the game design and the mechanics? And we already kind of discussed a little bit about the process, but
I'm an artist by trade. And I have zero background in designing a game. I've never designed a game before.
Wow.
So when this idea came to fruition that we wanted to do this, I needed to do some research. So I started looking at other card games that I enjoyed playing. And one of the ones I looked at was Gwent, which is a spin-off game from the Witcher video game. And it's not technically a physical card game. It's an online card game. And I loved that mechanic, and I loved, like Hordes of Power, each card kind of told a story about that character and was interlocked and weaved into the narrative and the mythology of that world. And I wanted to kind of keep that with Hordes of Power. That was something, I looked at that mechanic. And there's a French racing game called Millbourne. You're basically in a race and you're trying to accumulate as much mileage as possible. And the whole time you're trying to slow down your opponents by racing, by throwing potholes and like flattening their tires and making them run out of gas. So I kind of took a bit of that mechanic and tweaked it heavily into Hordes of Power, where you're trying to build an army of power instead of gathering miles. And then instead of throwing potholes and empty gas tanks at your opponent, you're throwing murders and kidnaps and brainwashes at your opponent. So that game mechanic, the Gwent game mechanic, I borrowed bits and pieces of those. I took some of my own. There's a mechanic in the game of being good and evil and aligned and misaligned with how the cards work together, depending on if they're all good or all evil, if they work together well or if they don't work together well. That was completely original idea. And I kind of mashed all those ideas into one, play tested it with you and others and got feedback. And that was kind of how the mechanics of the game came together for this first time game maker.
Really impressed. But I imagine, and I know from watching you do it, there's a lot of your engineering degree going into this, because you had to count the number of cards, you had to analyze the power, this one gives you a plus one, this one gives you a plus two. There's a lot of math involved in kind of keeping track of all that, right?
Yeah, I built this. I'm almost ashamed to say, my engineering helicopter hard science background, I built this huge, massive spreadsheet. I have all the cards broken down by power and ability. And I wanted to make sure that every facet of the game was balanced, that, you know, good wasn't more powerful than evil, that the savage cards weren't more powerful than the sorcery cards. And yeah, there was hours and hours of me sitting alone in front of a spreadsheet crunching these numbers.
Well, you had to, because again, that goes into making it fun.
Yeah.
Because you can't be, like you said, too unbalanced, like we were talking about in that first few iterations. It just wasn't fun because it was out of balance, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So you kind of had to do that.
That was the non-fun part of making this game, is the hours and hours of crafting the mechanics and making sure the math was right. Yeah. And then I could start drawing the cards once the math was right. Yeah. And then it gets fun.
Well, that segues into the next question. What's your favorite part of making the game? So the least favorite part was the spreadsheet.
Right. Drawing the cards. I mean, obviously I'm an artist and by trade, and that's what I loved, drawing the cards and just coming up with all these characters, even actually probably more than drawing them and coming up with the world building, is when it started to get to a point that I could start sharing it with a larger group. Because initially, like I said, it was just me and my daughter, then it was you and me, and then it was with this small group of other professional playtesters. And eventually it got good enough where I can, like, all right, I have a small group of friends that I want kind of a wider group of feedback on. These people are not gamers. They're a wide variety of normal folk. Well, I use normal loosely. Yeah. They're still my friends. Yes. They're not normal.
None of us are normal.
That was actually really magical too, because I would never be the player. I would just put the game out and I would let them play, and I would watch and I'd give feedback and I was taking notes. And watching your friends laugh and smile and have a good time doing something that you made is just like the most amazing feeling in the world. And that's probably my favorite part of making this game.
It was. I remember when sitting down with you the first few times, like, I think you're onto something here. And it wasn't long that we kind of figured out, yeah, this is going to be fun. So the art's the most fun. Well, watching people enjoy the game is the most fun, but
yeah, that's satisfying for sure.
Where did you get some of the ideas from? Did you see a picture of something on the internet or in a book or something, like, hey, I think that's something that maybe we can use, or because there's 64 characters, so that's a lot.
Yeah, the first 20 or 30 I think came pretty easily, just because there were just things that were always on my mind. Like I said, Master of the Universe was one of those first influences. So that was like the good first dozen or so cards were like, I need a He-Man card, you know, or a trope of this anyway. I need some trope like Evilor, a trope of Skeletor. I need a trope of Beastman. I need a trope of Manny Faces. These are just characters I loved in Master of the Universe, and I wanted to take their essence without like stealing the intellectual property, but taking that trope and then making it my own.
Yeah. Kind of like, I think there was one of them I remember we worked on was kind of a poison ivy. She's in control of plants, because that's kind of a common trope. That
Hedera the Green, the nature lady. Yeah, so once I got past the Master Universe, then I started looking at all the other things that were inspired me in my life. Like, I picked up the Warlord comic books done by Mike Grell in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. And that whole comic set in this inner world called Skartaris. And it's just this crazy world where there's like Atlantean technology left over from when Atlantis sank. There's dinosaurs that have come back. There's evil wizards that now rule the world. And I'm like, Skartaris is like, I want a world like this. So then I took that idea and I morphed it and tweaked it into primal and made this world where kind of anything goes, like Skartaris was for the warlord. So that's kind of the thing, you know. And then the sources just kept coming. And then some of them come from inside jokes with friends, you know. Like there's this one card called the Council of Khaznor. And it's basically an army of these robotic clones that are like self-replicating. If you're not paying attention to them, there's like 10 of them there, and you turn around, there'll be like 20 next time you look. Yes. Like they just keep making themselves, right, for no reason. That's totally based off a friend of mine who started collecting Kevin Costner action figures. I don't know why to this day he started doing it, but he did. And everyone thought it was quirky, so everyone started buying him Kevin Costner figures.
As a joke.
So he went from like 6 to like 40, like in a month. So that became the joke of this Council of Khaznor instead of Costner, and where these clones are like replicating when you least expect it. And of course, in the art, they all kind of look a little bit like Kevin Costner out of the Robin Hood movie, because that's obviously his seminal role in my book. But anyway, cards like that are fun, where there's inside jokes with friends, things that have meant something to me with people that I, you know, share my good times with. I'm able to embed those Easter eggs into the game, and that's been an amazing fun thing to do.
You can hear Eddie over at the Make Eternia Great Again podcast, and maybe you can bug him about the Khaznor thing. But
yeah, I was trying to leave his name out because I didn't want all his fans to start mailing him Kevin Costner figures.
Please mail him lots of Kevin Costner figures.
I'm sorry, Eddie. On the record, it was Lee Searcy's fault. I left your name off the record.
There's like 5,000 Kevin Costner figures because they aren't that expensive.
Well, for a reason.
Well, I love that. So yeah, just all these little things that you kind of picked up from just day-to-day activity, or hey, that'd be a great idea, like Buck Rogers, or you know, just other things that you just, hey, I'd like to do something like that, and mishmash them together.
Yeah, several cards are mismatches of these tropes, and they're just super fun.
Well, if someone wants to make their own game, we kind of talked about the good and the bad, what's some advice that you would give them, saying, you know, I did this, it didn't work out too well, you might want to go over here?
I guess the biggest piece of advice, I wish I would have gotten involved with that group of local game designers earlier, because I really didn't get linked up with them until about maybe 4 months into game development. And I would have saved so much time and effort. Just surround yourself with smart people. Smart, collaborative, fun-loving people, and it'll make the process so much easier, because creating a game by yourself is not fun and it's hard. But when you have smart people that just want to help and collaborate, then it becomes an amazing process.
And several of them have already published a game, so they kind of know and helped you with some of the hurdles, right?
Yeah. Some of them, like I said, are amateur game designers like me. Maybe they're on their first game or their second game. And then some of them are like, you know, they've published multiple games and they have a lot of experience, and being able to lean on them and not repeat the mistakes that they made was huge. You know, what's that old saying? Like, good men learn from their own mistakes, but great men learn from the mistakes of others.
Yep. That's perfect. I love that. Because, yeah, they were able to help, I think, with some of the mechanic and get some of those things weeded out. Because when do you think you started, you know, springish of last year, so, you know, April of 2019, when did you come to the point where, okay, I think the mechanics are fine, it's kind of done other than the artwork?
That was probably right before Christmas. April, May was mostly just kind of brainstorming. Most of the summer was just basic game development. And that was when it was just you and me and my daughter kind of involved, just the three of us. And then when that kind of got sorted to where it was good enough to show to other people, that's when I started showing it to that friend group. And then in mid-fall, that's when I got involved with that playtesting group. And then things really sped up with all their knowledge and expertise. And I would say by Christmas, the game mechanics were pretty much locked. The good idea faucet got shut off, for lack of a better term. We're like, all right, this game's got to go into full production. And then it's just started knocking out the art. And I've been pretty much just drawing these cards from December until now. Hopefully it's going to be done here by the end of May or early June, because I've been knocking out a card about every other day or so, every 3 days on average. And then begins the fun part of marketing and distribution and promotion. And not that I've been kind of doing that already, but it's going to go into high gear once the game's done and get it out there so the public can enjoy it.
Definitely. So that took a solid 8 months of just playtesting and asking questions and getting feedback.
Starting over.
There was, you started over at least
once
for sure.
We had one complete reboot. And then at least 20 or 25 small like tweaks, version changes.
2.9 or whatever now.
Yeah, I'm in version 2.24 or something. But yeah.
Yeah, that was fun though. I think just the little bit I've been involved with, I think, yeah, lots of playtesting.
A little bit. Yeah, you're selling yourself short. You've been a tremendous influence this game and done a lot of playtesting. Not only given ideas on game mechanics and playtesting, but you've given a lot of inspiration to the game too. I remember we had a couple of sessions where we would sit down and I'm like, here's the characters I want and give me your ideas. And you would just like spit out, you know, this is what this character's personality should be. And this is what this character should kind of look like. And yeah, you contributed in so many ways and I can't thank you enough for helping me out in this game.
You're welcome. It's fun. Thanks for letting me play in the Hordes of Power sandbox. It's been fun. But yeah, I think one thing I would mention to anybody wanting to do a game is just lots of play testing. I mean, you have to work out. I remember we just would play over and over. Okay, how did this go too fast? You know, what about when we add this card? Does this, right. How does this mess with the mechanics? Is it making it too long?
It's like a scientific method. You try to control certain things. We're like, hey, when, you know, I remember we would, at the early stages, we would try to do that. Like, hey, let's try six cards. Let's try seven cards. Yeah. Let's just play this card and see what happens. Let's leave out this card and see what happens. And
that's so, right. Yeah. We were even, okay, how about eight cards? Is that too many? Six, two, not enough. And just right. There's every little facet of, cause you have to do that because once it gets out in the wild, so to speak, yeah. You can't take it back.
Well, I'm sure there will be that way. Yeah. I'm sure I'll release this game and there'll be like, I'll get like a dozen questions a day. Like, hey, what about this? And I'll be like, dang it. I didn't think about that. Yeah. We should have play tested that facet.
Oh man. Yeah. Good point.
But I think that happens with every game though. Even professionally, released games, they occasionally have their little hiccups. So, but I promise it will be minimal. This game has been play tested by about a dozen or more people hundreds and hundreds of times. So there are no major tweaks to it. I mean, or issues. With it.
There shouldn't be.
No, it's going to be minor things that just whatever, but someone smarter than us figures out. But
well, the art is beautiful, so I commend you on that. And
thank you.
Kind of leads into the future plans of the game, I guess, once it's released in June, July-ish. What do you see, or what are some fun things, maybe things that you really want to do, and then maybe some things that are kind of far out there. If I had money and time, I would do X.
Well, hopefully, first and foremost, this COVID pandemic kind of goes away and we can all kind of get back to some semblance of normal. And I'm definitely going to be hitting the convention trail, hitting all the gaming stores in the local like tri-state area and trying to push this game out. It's going to be the biggest thing I'm going to be doing once, you know, I can get out of my house.
Exactly.
and see people. Projects that could build on this game. If the game's successful, I already have ideas for an expansion pack leading off this game that'll feature artifacts and locations within the game. So special items and special places within the world of Primal that'll have like either minor influence of the game or just like earth shattering. I mean, some of the ideas I have could be like just a totally flip the game. And I think it'd be fun. It could be fascinating expansion pack that could really add hours and hours of replayability to the game and introduce new facets of strategy while still keeping that simple motif. That's one thing I've got cooking on the side. But
so like 20 cards, you're thinking expansion?
Probably closer to 15.
15. Okay.
And that's only based on my experience. When you buy like a Magic the Gathering pack, it's usually like 15 cards in a booster pack. So that's Magic seems to have figured out the formula, so why tweak it? But anyway, we'll see. We'll see how many ideas I have. It may be 12, it may be 18. I don't know, but it'll kind of depend on, again, how many ideas I have. So that's one thing that's cooking. And another thing that I would love to do, and you mentioned this earlier, that all these characters in the world of Primal and these cards, you get a little glimpse into like a story and you can see that they have relationships with other characters. Some of them they hate each other. Some of them love each other. Some of them, you know, are sidekicks, albeit worthless.
Is there going to be a Puffle story?
No. There will be stories Puffles will die in, but there won't be a Puffle
That's
story.
That's a funny, maybe at the end of each one of these stories, Puffle dies.
Puffles dies.
Kind of like Kenny or, you know.
I love that.
That's a good idea.
Once again, Lee Searcy, the idea machine that I can't thank enough. But yeah, I would love to do a series of like short stories or short comics, something of that nature, where, you know, maybe you see the adventures of Lucky Bottoms and Calico Cow, and they go on an adventure to do something. And along the way, you know, they have to fight Lady Bata, and Puffles meets an inglorious end, and, you know.
Caught in the crossfire.
Right. I would love to get into some of these stories.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
Fun.
And then you have like a Buckle Backflash. He's at his ship. It's like, how did his ship get there?
How did he crash land on this planet? And what technology's lost on his ship? And why does Lady Bata want it? You know, and whatever. So yeah, I think those stories would be fun. I've also had some people, and this is like a way off idea. I know a guy that he has some relatives that are in like toy building and toy development. He's like, he was looking at some of my cards and he's like, these characters in these cards would like make perfect toys or like plush stuffed animals, like Puffles, for example. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
Wouldn't that be ironic that Puffles is the plush toy that sells a million of them?
Right. Yeah. I'm putting it down the whole time as he's like patting my bank account.
Or you're not too proud to take money that Puffles made you?
Oh, no. No. I would gladly live off Puffle royalties for the rest of my life if he goes viral.
That's awesome.
I will despise him to my grave, but I will live off his money in hypocrisy. But yeah, so I've had people that say like, these would be great toys or stuffed animals. And I was like, well, that's great. I don't know how to make toys or stuffed animals. So it would be one of these ideas that I would totally have to collaborate with a toy maker on. I don't have the inclination, time, or energy to like totally branch off into that field.
Ooh, hey, Todd McFarlane, if you're listening, Lee is not too proud to sell the rights to the Hordes of Power action figures.
I'll send Todd McFarlane in that toy company a demo deck or the Seven Horsemen or some of these other ones.
Exactly. No, that I agree. I think this would make an excellent toy line. Well, that makes sense because you kind of based it off Motu. I mean,
yeah, a lot of these are based off toys, so it would make sense to turn it back and be full circle. There's some Hordes of Power merchandise out there, not toys per se, but I do have some of the art like on tpublic.com. You can get shirts, coffee mugs, pillows, laptop cases, magnets,
anything.
Totes.
They're amazing. The art, you have to see the art, and I'll include a link in the show notes to some of these cards and in the link there where you can buy the merchandise and get a hold of the artwork because it's just fantastic. And I think we can you get them on in posters yet or anything like that? Or
you can get posters on there. You can't get like the big tapestries because I mean this art was done card size.
That's
so
true.
When you blow it up tapestry, it gets kind of wonky.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can get small prints. Like I said, you can get shirts, sweatshirts, magnets, stickers, cell phone cases, coffee mugs. Well, and then also another recent development. Another friend and great creative person that I work with, Kim from Starlight Studios Vinyl Designs, she made this great Hordes of Power tumbler glass, or not tumbler, but like a cup, like an insulated tumbler cup with some of my art on it. And so, yeah, if you're interested in that, I would give her full range to use licensed Horde of Power logos. If you want to support another great local creator, find out with Starlight Studios Vinyl Designs and she'll make you some Hordes of Power stuff.
Awesome. Yeah, she can make pretty much anything.
Yeah, she's an amazingly talented
really
woman.
Really good at that. But yeah, now, this is a great game. I encourage everybody to check out the game here and keep an eye on Lee Bachman. In fact, why don't you tell the listener where they can reach out to you and kind of keep tabs on what's coming and when it's ready to go.
Okay. I just actually in the last week launched the Hordes of Power website. So yeah, it's hordesofpower.weebly.com because I am too cheap to spring for a full domain name yet. It will eventually, but for right now it's free through the Weebly site, but you can go and check that out. And then I'm all over the social media, Art of Lee Bachman. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at that same handle. So you just type in Art of Lee Bachman. If I don't show up, your computer's not working right.
And he has samples of all the artwork and you can kind of keep track of how it's progressing. And I'm sure when this thing launches, it'll be all over social media, website, and everything too.
Yeah, it'll be a big push, definitely, on all the social medias.
Pick up your copy. I guess, question, how much is this going to cost when it does come out? Have you set out a price?
Right. So it's $20 for a game, which is pretty much standard. If you look at other card games, they're usually in that $15 to $25 range off the shelf. It should compete with those games, like a 108 card deck. It comes with two play mats that are interconnected, so you can play with them separately. You can connect them together, and it makes an art piece on the connected game boards. It'll come with two patented pending Hordes of Power Pebbles, which is a really fancy name.
PPP.
For a couple of rocks that you use to keep score with. Yeah, no, it'll be a high quality product. $20. I'm hoping to have it at a lot of the local game stores here in Eastern Nebraska, Western Iowa, and maybe in Kansas. I'm going to hit the convention tour. So if you're at some of the conventions across the Midwest, when the conventions start back up, look for my booth and find some Hordes of Power. And, contact me through any of those social media sites or on that website. We'll ship it to you.
Yeah, and I know we're working on a video and explain how to play the game. So that'll be another way in the future that you can see exactly how this game plays and be able to kind of figure out if there's something you want to play or not and see the artwork. Again, the artwork's amazing. The gameplay is great. So I think you got a hit on your hands.
Well, thank you.
So I think it's going to work.
Wow. And like I said earlier, thank you so much for helping me with this. You're, you know, de facto co-creator of this thing, and this, for as much feedback and play testing as you've done, then I can't thank you enough.
You're welcome. It's been fun. I enjoyed it. And to the listener, keep in touch, and I'll have a link in the show notes to the website and everything else. And so anything else you want to plug, Lee, before we sign off here?
I think I've done enough shameless plugs for one day. I think all the plugs have been shamelessly filled for now. Oh, so.
And contact Lee about Puffles. He just loves Puffles.
Yeah, send me your Puffles stories. I would love to not read them.
So send Lee Bachma Puffles stories, and send Eddie of Mega lots of Costners.
If somebody sends me some Puffles fan art, I would actually love that. That would be
actually
amazing.
That actually is flattery.
I've had another artist and friend of mine, Jesse Kiefer, he's done some fan art sketch cards of Uklar the Mighty and Evilor the Evil, and he gave them to me, and I about like came out of my shoes. It was so amazing. But yeah, if some random listener out there wants to send me some fan art, Puffles or otherwise, I would be forever in your debt.
Awesome. Oh, cool. Well, thanks, Lee. I appreciate it. So awesome to sit down and talk with Lee. He's a great guy, very talented, love the guy, and I really do thank him for letting me have the opportunity to work with him on this project. So again, if you have questions or comments about this episode or previous episodes, go to covertnerd.net for all the ways that you can get in touch with me. Simply click on the information button on whatever podcast catcher you're using, and you'll see all the links that we talked about in the show. So until next time, nerd it up. If you're listening to this, you are a true fan, so I want to thank you and congratulate you. What I'd like you to do is, if you are the first one to email me, you get a free Hordes of Power card game. What you do is simply email me, cn@covertnerd.net. That's cn@covertnerd.net. Put in the subject line, HOP winner, and I will mail you a copy of the Hordes of Power card game. Congratulations, and thank you for listening.